Hello, I'm Joe Morrison, and this is Generous Questions, a podcast about philosophy that's made at the Department of Philosophy at Queen's University, Belfast. In this episode, I talk with Aoife, a philosophy student who was working on a dissertation to do with Icelandic sagas. Aoife's research takes in moral theories, historical and anthropological reconstruction, and different approaches to understanding character traits. I know next to nothing about Icelandic sagas, except that they're really, really long, and they have a complicated history of family feuds and vendetta. Well, actually, I knew a little bit more than that before we started recording, because Aoife had given a research presentation earlier in the year. You see, every year our philosophy students get to go on a retreat to the mountains of Mourn in Northern Ireland, and we spend a couple of days hiking in the Granite Hills and staying up late talking about philosophy. Aoife had volunteered to give a work in progress talk while we were there to share her interests and to generate some discussions of the central ideas to help her develop her project. I think everyone was fascinated by the topic, and there was some really healthy and enthusiastic debate about some of the things that Aoife was saying. I noticed that when we recorded this episode many months later, Aoife had changed some of the things that she wanted to say about how she was understanding the moral framework that comes across in the sagas. And that's really refreshing to see that she'd taken that opportunity at that retreat to try out some of those ideas, and that the process of talking about them with other people and reflecting on them further meant that she'd updated her views. We had so much to talk about that this has turned into quite a long episode, and I suppose that's appropriate given that we're talking about Icelandic sagas. Actually, I've had some really lovely emails and messages from listeners who've got in touch to tell me that they're enjoying Generous Questions, and several people have said that they'd be interested in episodes being a bit longer, a bit more generous. I'm still not quite sure how this podcast is going to develop. I'll keep working on improving it, but I'm quite happy for this conversation to go out nearly an hour long. If you've got any feedback, or if you'd like to follow up on any of the topics that have been covered so far, you're really welcome to get in touch. You can drop me a line through the podcast website, www.generousquestions.co.uk, or you can get me on Twitter, at Dr. Joe Morrison, all one word. It's been so nice to receive your messages so far, and I'm genuinely surprised and delighted to discover that people in the world are prepared to actually give a little bit of their time and energy to send me a message. Thanks to every one of you, and thanks to everyone who's shared or retweeted or liked or listened to any of these episodes. It really means a lot. I asked Aoife for some reading suggestions for you lot, and I've put them in the episode notes. But since Aoife's topic is so highly original and independent, there's really not a lot of moral philosophy that's been written on the subject. Still, there's more than enough for you to get stuck into, and reading a saga will definitely take up a bit of your time. Anyway, over to the episode. You're listening to Generous Questions, and this is Aoife talking about morality in the Icelandic sagas, although we actually start the conversation talking about karaoke.
If Belfast had one of those karaoke bars where you just got a room, a private room to yourself, and you and your mates got to say, you know, the ones like, yeah. So you sort of have them in like Japan or whatever, and like, would you do that? Would you go along just for like for a night? You hire out a room just so that you and your mates can get drunk?
I feel like I would. This all started because I went to the ABBA Museum in Sweden. Not my choice. And then we went, and there was like a bit at the end where there was like these really bad like holograms of like the ABBA people, whoever they are. And then and like you had to like get up, but like, you know, if you were like following dance moves, you would like expect it to like lag so that you would do it at the same time, but they didn't. They did it at the same time as you were meant to move.
Bloody hell.
So you had to like guess what they were going
to
do.
You had to know.
But you also had to sing at the same time whilst concentrating on this, which didn't work.
It just proves how hard it is to be an ABBA, right?
Yeah, like their lives must have been. I walked away and I had like a newfound appreciation for ABBA. Yeah. Like I listen to it now and I'm like,
their work rate is just so
super trooper. It's a piece of art.
Okay, I want to ask you about your philosophy.
Yeah, let's get away from it.
No, that's good. Let's start. Why don't you introduce yourself? Tell me, who are you?
I am Aoife.
So you're a final year student here.
Yeah.
And what are you studying?
Philosophy.
Just straight philosophy?
Straight philosophy.
Good. What made you pick straight philosophy to study as a degree?
I did GCSE philosophy and then I did A-level philosophy.
Wow.
So this has been...
So there was never any question?
No, I was just like, well, if I'm going to go and do anything, I'm probably going to, you know, continue with the flow of traffic. Then I decided I'm just going to do something random. So I was like Northumbria Uni that year were running a course, like they were starting a course in politics and international studies.
Yeah.
Which I cannot describe my... my life would have been terrible if I'd done that course. No. Like hindsight is 2020, yeah. And like 18-year-old me was like, look at all this politics, I can vote now. I'm going to go and do like international studies. And it was like, no, it wouldn't have been right.
You're committed to being more abstract than that.
Yeah, okay. I was like, it wouldn't have made sense like at all. Like I did a politics module in first year and I sat there and I was like, oh, if this had been 3 years, this would have been the worst.
So what exactly is the problem with studying politics?
The terrible people on the terrible degree pathway.
No, it's because the facts. It's because all the numbers.
It's just like, yeah. And also just like, it's not like, I don't think like that. My brain doesn't go onto that like path.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, Dad, you know what? This really isn't going to work for me. And he went through a list of universities that do philosophy.
Wow.
And he was just like, Belfast. And I was like, that's it. That's where I'm going to go. Like,
wow.
And he was like, oh, I don't know about that. That's a bit... I remember Belfast, hearing things about Belfast. I don't know about Belfast. And I was he was like stuck in like 70s, 80s.
He was thinking of the Troubles. He was...
Yeah. Okay. And he was like... Well, I don't think many people get like shot anymore, so maybe it would be okay.
And then is it?
you know, I've heard things, but okay. I'm alive. And he was like, well, and I was like, decision made, that's it. I'm going to go and do that at school tomorrow. I'm going to tell them to help me.
Genuinely. So you put down philosophy at
Queen's. I'd never been to Belfast.
And it was just a complete wild card.
It was just like,
wow,
YOLO.
So you took a roll of the dice and you came to Queen's and you've been studying here for 2 and a bit years now. And this, your third and final year of this degree, I can see the tears on your face. I know it's coming to an end.
I am remorseful.
But tell me about, you're doing a dissertation.
Yeah.
So you chose this topic yourself.
Yeah.
You get to finally use all of the skills that you've acquired over the last couple of years and you get to focus them precisely on the one and only thing.
What little skill I have will be channeled.
And what is this one and only thing that you focused on?
I'm doing ethics and morality in Hrafnkell Saga Freyskode, which is just a saga in Iceland.
Do you want to just say that again slowly?
I don't think I can. I deliberately went through that quickly.
Ethics and morality in...
Hrafnkell's saga Freyskode.
Okay, so this is an Icelandic saga.
Yeah, then I'm understanding it through virtue ethics.
Okay.
So I'm like gonna...
Wait, good. Okay, let me ask about that. So what is your question something like this? The way to understand the morality that we see going on in this saga is a kind of virtue ethics. Is that your question? Is it or is it not a form of virtue ethics?
Yeah,
that's your
probably going to say yeah.
You're probably saying it is a kind of virtue ethics, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me about this. So okay, you've chosen a project all about Icelandic sagas.
Yeah, I'm not even sure I fully understand.
Where does that come from?
Well, another long-winded roll of the dice. So, yeah. Strange fixation on trouble.
Go on.
So, like when I was like 16 or 17, my dad was like, I want to go to Iceland. And I was like, oh, you know, whatever. So me, my dad, and my nana went to Iceland. And I went to a museum on Icelandic sagas.
Oh, yeah, and we are talking about the country here. Good.
Yeah, like, not the shop.
Good.
Although they do frozen Greg's food. So okay. They just put in the oven. It's like being in Greg's.
So you went to Iceland?
I was like, do you know what? Beautiful landscape, wonderful people. Great culture, it's an all-rounder. And then we went to Icelandic Sagas Museum, and I was like, this is so cool. Like, they've got like these, like, I don't know, you're talking like 800-year-old books with a language which is borderline not changed at all. So like Icelandic people can read things in like, whereas if you think about how hard we find reading like Shakespeare or something,
yeah.
I was like, take that and like nearly double that amount of time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're reading things like with dates and people and your ancestry. And I was like, this is really, it's quite interesting.
So it's sort of real living history, sort of really
yeah, like
deeply
you would,
connected.
If
yeah.
you were an Icelander, you would, I imagine, feel quite a heavy investment in it.
Yeah.
Because it's like not only like history, but it's like really interesting literature.
And is that how you think of it? Do you think of it as I literally know nothing about this. Is the right way to think about these sagas as history, sort of factual, or as kind of literature, as fiction, as stories?
Kind of up for debate, I think. I think the majority of people would say, well, it's not written at the time, so it's not like I'm sitting here and I'm like, it's oh, Joe's doing a podcast, yeah, and right. We're sat in Belfast. Like,
that's so meta.
So it's kind of like hindsight. Like, okay. So it's written in like the late 12th, 13th and 14th century, about like the time when Iceland was settled. So you're talking between like the first parliament in the world being set up. So that was like 930 plus 100 years.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's like between 100 year period they're talking about.
Wow. Okay. So and this is like, so like an oral tradition that's been passed on until it was eventually written down or something, one of those things.
This is another thing that's up right. for debate. So some people think it was like oral stories until like Icelandic language was communicated in a written form.
Yeah.
And then some people think that it's just written.
Yeah.
Okay. The history on it's a bit
just written.
It's just up for people for debate.
Okay. Maybe. So obviously like you've had to dig into all this stuff. Tell me back. So you have been to Iceland, you've got this interest in Icelandic sagas,
yeah,
as a sort of literary form or history or whatever. How do you connect that to doing a philosophy dissertation? How do you fill in those dots?
Because like I feel like when you read them, they're so like charged with like right and wrong.
Okay.
Whether they, like it's not necessarily said like, and here is a really great guy and here's a really bad guy. Well, it is, but there's also like nuances to it. Like you have all these behaviors that are kind of expected of you. So like in one of the sagas, I think I might be right in saying he's called like Brodhelgi or something.
Mm-hmm.
But he gets hit in the head by this man and he just kind of gets up and he's like, oh no, it's not that one. He's called Thorstein Staffstruck because he gets hit with a staff.
Good, good
makes
name.
Sense.
Perfect.
Names
are descriptions.
Yeah, so and he gets hit with a staff by this guy. And he's just gets up and he's just like pretends nothing's happened and he like walks away and he like pretends that it was just an accident and he doesn't talk about it.
Right.
And his dad finds out that he was hit in the head like a year later and he's like, you're such an embarrassment to our family. I would rather have a dead son than a son who won't stand up for himself. You're such a coward, you this, that and the other. So he goes and like kills this man like a year later and he's like, see, dad, I told you I wasn't that much of a weakling. Like, look at me.
Good.
So it's just like, there's yeah. all these things that you're just like so charged with like normative value.
Right. So you got courage and you got cowardice and you got vengeance, yeah. retribution, payback, dignity, how you hold yourself up in that society, that kind of stuff. So yeah. is your thought like, oh, we've actually got some pretty complicated or rich moral characters. They're not yeah. two-dimensional. They're not just yeah. like goodies and baddies there.
Yeah. And I think that's because like a lot of the sagas, you might read them and you might be like, it seems like everyone's bad.
Okay, right.
But there's something underlying it. And I think when you attach it to the landscape of settlement Iceland, like in 930 AD, there was the first parliament in the world set up. So you're talking about within 60 years of settling a country, killing all the Irish monks that were there, settling it, taking it over, felling the land, setting everything up, and then going, we need a parliament structure.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's some sort of like political investment.
Yeah.
But then there's also like a tie to the morality of the people.
Okay.
Like, so what the way that the government worked was that there was laws, but no official punishment. So the punishment that was set up was by, there was like chieftains, but they weren't just chieftains. They were like priests as well, because you would have had pagan gods.
Yeah.
So they would have had like, they would have been the most powerful in society. So if someone hit you over the head with a staff, you might go to the Althingi, which is the first parliament that year, and they ran every year. So you might go there and in 930, you might be like, this guy hit me over the head with a staff and I'm not very happy about it. And they might say, oh, it's illegal to hit people with staffs. So what are we going to do about it? And then you would sit down, the Gothi would then decide what to do about him. So they might exile him,
right.
or they might remove so much of his financial gain or his land or whatever power he has.
Yeah.
So I think you've got this like, it's like self-policing culture.
Okay. Like, what you describe there sounds like there's a kind of political, like you say, there's a parliament, but at the same time, that's also doing something legal. So there's a kind of legal structure there. But you think there's also part of that, or separate from that, a distinctive type of moral framework or something that's... Do you think... Because it sounds like there's this sort of extrajudicial sense of morality, which is where you just go and enact revenge on a person who's humiliated you, right? And that's got nothing to do with this parliament, or it is to do with that?
Well, no, there are expectations kind of around that. Like, feud culture is part of like conflict resolution, almost.
Feud like...
So, like, you were mean, like, to my son, you disrespected us, so now my family's at war with your family, and I'm going to get my men, and my men are going to come and kill your men, and loads of people are going to die.
These are family feuds. So
the sagas are pretty much family feuds. You have like romantic sagas or whatever, but the ones that I'm focusing on, they are the family sagas, and they do tend to tell a story of like, this person was the son of a Norwegian king, and then he came over, and he had this son, and this son, and this son, and that's why you're here.
Yeah.
So you then... Like you meet like Raff and Kel, and then he does something, and this brings it in with this family, and then.
Good. Okay. So I'm getting a sense of the themes and the ideas, and I can see why this is sort of grabbing, because these are all things that people in political philosophy talk about, and also in ethics, right? I can totally see that. I guess. I mean, I've got a bunch of questions about all of that, but let's just go. So you started with this idea, I want to do something about the Icelandic sagas, and I want to do something philosophical about the Icelandic sagas. Or were you quite content that this could be a project that looks like political philosophy? I mean, did you have a clear sense, no, I want it to be more obviously kind of moral philosophy?
Oh, no, I want it to be moral. I want to stay as far away from politics as I can get.
Yeah.
That's why I'm here.
Yeah, right. Okay. So no, but seriously, that's so that you had the clear sense that like, let's keep these two separate. I don't want to be talking about the moral, the political structures and those kinds of things, or the notions of authority and leadership, or you know, how does this state operate? You're not interested in those.
Yeah,
questions.
Like I was faced with like a couple of things I could have done.
Yeah,
like I could have gone into virtue ethics, or I could have gone into like maybe like a Hegelian sort of like where the like social structure and whether the power struggle or I didn't even really get that deep into research in that, because I just thought,
not for you.
No, I don't want it. If this is my passion project, it's going to be something I at least have half an interest in rather than politics.
Okay. So, right. So tell me how it's gone. Tell me how do you find the process of having that initial idea, which is like, I want to do something about Icelandic sagas, and I'm really interested in moral philosophy, and I definitely don't want to do political theory. So how do you go from there to wherever you're at now? And I'll ask you how you do, where is that right at the moment, in a minute?
Where am I at now?
No, to answer that in a minute, but how have you gone from that initial part to actually having something that looks like a project? How has that worked out? What was the process?
Well, bought my dad a book of Icelandic sagas for Christmas a while ago, and he never read them because there's too many names and it all gets a bit confusing.
Yeah.
So I was like, do you know, if you're not going to read it, I am.
Yeah.
And I read it and I was like, the idea that you would like hit someone, you would go and kill someone because they hit you. Mm. Or like in the saga that I'm doing like an analysis of, he has a horse and he's like, if anyone rides my horse, I will kill you. And like, the hands of a man who warns someone is clean, so that's your warning. I will have your life if you touch my horse. Someone rides his horse, so he kills him. And the whole thing comes out of this. So I was like, this idea that you would like have a duty towards a promise you'd made yourself, like an oath, whether an oath has some sort of meaning, whether Einar, who rode the horse, whether he is somehow morally to blame. Like, he acknowledged his responsibility not to break that oath, but he did. Or whether his dad's to blame because he gets really heavily invested in this storyline and he takes it too far. Or whether his nephew who tries to help him is morally to blame because he tries to seek financial gain out of the situation. Or whether it's the original person's fault for just making a crazy oath, or whether they all have massive character flaws which make them all equally to blame.
So you're reading the saga and you're going like, okay, there's something crazy here that looks out of proportion, but
yeah,
like, at the same time these guys all seem to understand what they're doing.
Like it's almost like, so Raff and Kel, who owns the horse, he's like kind of noted as a bit of a bad guy. Mm-hmm. So he is a Gothi, which is where I think the power situation comes in, because he is one of the most powerful in society. But not only that, but he's feared by everyone. He's noted for killing other people and not having any form of like settlement. So in Icelandic culture, you might kill someone's son. So basically what he does is he kills Einar, and he's like, I feel actually quite bad about this one, because he was quite a good guy.
Right.
So he says to
Thjorbjörn, but he had to do it because he's like,
I had no choice. Right. I warned him and I'd made an oath. So my honour would have been at stake if I'd broken my oath. And then people would just walk all over me and I'm in a situation of power. Mm. So honour is my responsibility to uphold, because if I don't...
So your thought here is that he doesn't genuinely really want to kill this guy, but he feels like he has to because of some sort of performance about his character that he has to uphold. There's a character that he really has, and there's a character that he has to be seen to have.
Oh no, I think he is a terrible person.
Okay, right.
Like he is like a bad person, but he's like, Einar is like quite a good person.
Yeah.
So like for context, he takes a job as a shepherd because his dad is like really poor. Like his family is destitute because he has more kids than he can feed. So Einar is like the oldest and he's his dad's favourite. And his dad says to him, can you go and get a job? And he's like, oh, but you've like made me miss all the good jobs. Like if you told me a few months ago, I would be fine. But now I'm only going to get the worst of the worst.
Right.
So he goes to Hrafnkell and he's like, can I have a job? And he's like, I've only got one, but you're not going to want it because it's a shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
So in Icelandic culture, it was actually against the law to make your standard farmhands become shepherds during like the season where you would need to get, because they would take milk from the sheep as well as wool and meat.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd milk the sheep. And it was illegal to make your standard farmhands do that because it was such a lowly job.
Wow, okay.
So Hrafnkell's...
Because of a gendered sense, there should be women who
no, just know. Like, it's for young people. Oh, I see. It's not okay. Like a... It's not reputable. Not a you just don't want to...
Right.
Yeah, like it's... Yeah, like it's... You don't really want to do it. Like, okay. So Hrafnkell does say, like, it's the only thing I've got and you're worth more than that. So
right, okay.
Do you want it? And he's like, yeah, I'm going to have to because like, my dad needs to. Like, yeah. My dad needs the money. He's got kids. Einar does demonstrate he is generally quite a good guy.
Yeah.
So Hrafnkell knows that. And he's like, he says to Thorbjorn, like, I actually do feel quite bad about this situation.
About killing Einar.
Yeah. So what I'm going
to
do.
And you think that's genuine remorse? That's supposed to be genuine remorse.
He says, it's not, I don't think he's sorry. It's just an acknowledgement. So he says, like, right. This is the worst of the ones I've done. So for that, I'm going to compensate you, because this is like kind of what you would do in Icelandic culture. It's the same kind
it's more,
of...
It's more about the exchange. It's not really about the... It's not really about how anyone feels. It's more about making sure that the right things are given to the right people at the right time.
I think it's kind of both. Right. So there is obviously like the retributive aspect. Like you put a mark on my family, you made us look weak, you dishonored me, you hurt my pride, so I'm gonna kill you.
Yeah.
Or also, you took something irreplaceable to me, I needed money from that boy, so settle me on that case.
Yeah.
So he says to Thorbjorn, like, it is the worst I've done, so I'm gonna settle with you. So I'm gonna give you meat in the winter, cows in the summer for milk. I'm gonna take one weird facet of Icelandic culture was fostering someone's children. So
I suppose it's a real cost. Yeah,
like I like will take your son,
yeah,
because I might have more reputable people for him to marry than you will. So he can marry up or she can marry up. You have no money, so I will look after them, or I will do it for political ties. Like, so in one of the sagas, there's a priest and he has a child, and this like wealthy but quite disliked man fosters the priest's son, and right. He says, but you have to have my back.
Okay.
I'll give your son the best start in life, but you have to have my back if anything goes wrong.
Yeah.
So it's like forming political ties. So Hrafnkell's like, I will take your children. I will look after them. I will make sure they're okay. And also, you can keep working on your land until you get sick of it, and then you can come and live with me until you die, and I'll give you everything you want. So he basically takes every problem that Thorbjorn's ever had away. And this is like the only example of Hrafnkell asking to settle with someone.
Okay.
So yeah.
It's quite a momentous moment, yeah, right? Like it's hard to see how it, until you've got that context, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, wow, this guy's really interested in settling for some reason.
Yeah. And it's like, because I think Einar has this character about him of like, there's this idea.
He was the good son. He was,
yeah. Okay. So there's a word, it's like Drengskaper. Maybe I'm saying that really wrong. Yeah. And it means like to be of upright character. It comes from like, upright stone in Icelandic, which is like drengs something, I don't know, but which also is men.
Okay.
It's like a deviation of different words. Like,
and so it's a moral evaluation. It's a thick concept.
Like Drengskaper is like being of upright character.
Yeah.
So I think the point is that like Einar is meant to be one of these of upright characters.
And do you think that has some sort of talk about him having had potential or that kind of thing? Is this idea that he could have gone far, he could have done something, he could have made a difference? Is it about the future, which has now been cut off because he's been killed? Or it's just about who he was at the time?
I think it's just who he was. Like, he's just like a generally, he's quite a stand-up guy. So it's like, yeah, I've killed other guys. They weren't the best of people. So like, I don't really feel that bad because they had it coming to them. It's this whole idea of like fate and whether that ties, which kind of ties to character. But like, for Einar, it's like he's quite a good guy, so I'm going to settle because, like, I see you needed him. He only did it because he was trying to get the sheep that he lost. So he was trying to be good, but I had an oath.
Right.
And my hands are, I take no, it's not that I'm taking guilt or responsibility. I'm just settling with you because.
So there's a notion of justice that's got nothing to do with blame or something.
Yeah, he's just like, this was the worst I've done, so I'll give you that.
It's an amazing kind of like this is a rich tapestry of like these connections between these people and everything they're doing has quite a sophisticated reason behind it. Like it's not just oh, I'm going to pay you back. It's I'm going to pay you back in a particular way for a particular reason.
Yeah, like I'm going to settle your whole life for you because that's the role your son had.
Right.
Like,
and in doing that, like, so you're looking at this. I'm wondering what's going through your head as you're looking at this, whether it's one way you can think about it is you're being like an anthropologist, right? So in an old fashioned notion of anthropology, it's like you've just been cutting through a forest and you've stumbled across a group of people who've been, you know, isolated from civilization for years, and you're kind of observing them and trying to work out what their customs are. And that's an old fashioned notion of anthropology, because I think nowadays we think that that's a little bit sort of supercilious of us, like, you know, we're civilized and these people are not, right? And that we're just like looking at them through a sort of telescope, trying to work out what their intentions are and what their meanings are. And like you say, this is a text that in some respects is kind of pretty contemporary, or it's readable in a contemporary language that Icelandic people still just read normally. Do you read Icelandic? Have you started
learning? Oh my God, no. Okay. Well, I like to like eat and sleep and, you know, shower sometimes. So I don't really have time learn this. Like, I was like, oh my God, look at me. I can say like two sentences. And I was like,
it does sound good.
I speak Icelandic. And then I went about being like, I'm going to do my saga and then I'm going to be able to read everything in Icelandic. And then I realized at some point I like to watch TV.
But okay, but so do you think what you're doing is a sort of philosophical anthropology here? You're looking at a different culture and you're just trying to fathom it you're trying to make sense of it in terms of a moral system that we understand already in, you know, the kind of stuff that we already teach in university here or something. Is that what you think the project is let me try and understand this alien other thing in terms which show up in the Western canon already? Is that the project, or am I getting that wrong?
You know, I haven't quite got this far.
Cool, okay.
So because I kind of think the more you read of the saga, so basically what happens is he gets given this very appetizing looking settlement.
Right.
And then he goes, no,
ah.
I'm going to take this to the parliament. Then we'll see what happens with you, because I want this settled by official judicial parties. I don't want this to just be, I'm not going to take what you give me. That's when Raffenkell says, well, this is where you've got it wrong, because now you're asserting that we're equals.
Well, because you think you can take me.
You think you can settle with me,
right,
and you get some say in it.
Yeah.
When it's not like that. I'm offering you. So then it kind of goes into like, what you see is kind of like, I think the fall of people comes from their excess.
Right.
So like
Like if there was a moral to this story, it could be that.
Yeah, which is kind of like, so you read it and you think, right, well, this maps onto virtue ethics. Like you, if the behavior of a character is like mirrored by their character.
Mm-hmm.
So like Thorbjorn overestimates his self-worth. Like everyone would think that is a reasonable settlement when you take it into context. Like you shouldn't, he is not going to get that off anyone else. Hrafnkell doesn't offer that to anyone else.
Okay.
Like, so he, his fall is in his greed, his sense of pride, and his overinflation of his self-worth.
Yeah.
And then Hrafnkell is just generally not that great of a person.
Right.
So everyone, so the whole story, like everyone falls down. And at the end, Hrafnkell's back in his original position. Sam, who is Thorbjorn's nephew, he ends up being kicked out of the land he'd taken over from Hrafnkell and ends up as a subordinate to Hrafnkell. Thorbjorn's profited basically nothing from this situation. It all just goes full circle. And it's like, it could have ended well for him if he hadn't had this overinflated sense of ego.
Do you think that's part of the point of these things? Is there's obviously a long form part to this narrative, which is that, look, this is just going to keep on happening. And that it starts making individuals seem a little bit irrelevant, because what's kind of more important is just the sort of continual flow of exchange, of promise, of giving and receiving, of sheep moving from one person to another, of seasons coming around again, those kinds of things. That is that supposed to be a kind of takeaway here? Sort of don't as a human, don't get above yourself and thinking that you're somehow important. What's actually more important is the sort of the bigger picture narratives about promises being upheld over generations. It's not really to do with you, an individual, and your personal qualities. It's about bigger stuff than that. And you're just a cog in this wheel, and you'll get chewed up like everyone else will get chewed up. That sounds quite nihilistic, but I mean, I'm trying to work out what it is that you're trying to, are you trying to extract a moral from this? Is that what you're trying to do?
I think I'm trying to map where the sagas fit into virtue.
Okay.
Like if you take virtue as just kind of like a way of living,
mm-hmm.
like, oh, we want to uphold like members of a state invested in the political sphere. They're good people. They're invested in a political sphere. Whether I act reasonably comes from like not acting out of excess and not acting out of deficiency. So I'm kind of just taking that theory and then going like, look, this is what the ethics of the sagas is talking about.
Right.
Like everyone's got an excess or a deficiency, and it transpires to be fault on their behalf.
Good. Okay.
So like, rather than having, if you had a story where everyone acted reasonably, you'd go, oh, that's virtuous behavior and that's virtue ethics. I'm just taking the negative outcomes it has.
Yeah.
And going, but that is a demonstration of virtue ethics. Because what I'm going to have like three sections. And in my second section, it's like talking about two other approaches to understanding like the normative value of the sagas.
Good.
So one of them is like, oh, it's Christian. It was written to teach people Christian message when they adopted Christianity.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the other one's like, no, it's just that like pagan behaviors rock and like they're communicating how like this heroic nature and like Hrafnkell's not a bad guy. He was fated to do this, and it was his destiny that he would make an oath and he would be stuck between two bad things and he would have this massive struggle because he was fated. So really we should feel bad for him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, okay.
And then so, I'm just kind of going, well, they don't really work. And this is kind of...
Right.
If you take a virtue understanding of it, it flows a bit better.
So on the Christian understanding, it would be something like... I mean, let me just guess, right? And you can just totally put me right or wrong. That would be something like, oh, look, all humans have, you know, free will, but they also are fallen. They have original sin. People are bad. People do bad things. People need to atone for their badness. You should try and find salvation in kind of making things right is an important sort of Christian virtue or something like that. I mean, I'm using the word virtue there, but it's to do with something like humans are fallen, right? So that's that. Is that the Christian component? Something
no,
like that?
It doesn't really talk about like original sin or anything.
Right.
So I would like to just thank a lovely little lecturer at Edinburgh University because it was a book that I could not get.
Yeah.
Could not get it on the internet, could not get it anywhere. And he sent me it.
Wow.
And I read it. And there's actually a bit in this book where he says, well, it's kind of like a Greek philosophy to do with virtue. But we're not going to talk about this here. Right. And I was like, oh, well,
time for me to talk about it.
Hand me my dissertation now. Excellent. Because you've just written it for me.
Yeah.
So it's not entirely dissimilar. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of talking about the author communicating a story of like well-deserved defeat and excessive pride and vengeance.
Oh, so these are like parables in the Bible?
Yeah, kind of. Right, so it's like, because basically what happened is like, they settled Iceland in like 870. And then by 930, they'd set up the first parliament. And then in the year 1000 AD, they took Christianity as the official religion.
Right.
From that point on, you've got to kind of think there was conversion tactics, or that either people ignored it and continued to have a pagan religion until they were nearly taken over by the Norwegians, or until they accepted a Norwegian sovereign or something. This period of the sagas directly overlaps this like 70 years pre-Christianity and the 30 years after.
So we're seeing like a project that's trying to blend the two. It's like make a hybridization or something.
Like when they're written, you would have to think you're at least somewhat charged with a Christian perspective. Like, look, we don't practice, like, I don't believe in the God of Frey anymore. I'm not going to like name my horse after it, or say that if anyone touches my part God horse, I will kill you.
Right.
Like, it's like,
This is a form of evangelism. It's to try and get people to give up the old gods and take on the new ones.
I think that's
how you're thinking of the Christian reading? Like that this is almost like not a manifesto, like a piece of propaganda. Look, things go badly for the old people using the old ways. Turn away from those ways of thinking, because
how badly things go. Interesting stories, but if you're charged with that Christian perspective, it's going to mirror it anyway. So it could potentially have been conversion tactics, or it could have just been like, look at us, we're such good Christians now, look at how the pagans got it wrong.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It doesn't have to be necessarily that you're a pagan being converted by reading a story.
Yeah.
But just kind of like, look how well we're doing, look how bad they did it.
Interesting. Yeah.
I don't know. Like,
yeah.
So
but you want to get away from the idea that these are parables. You just think, no, that's not the right way to do it.
Yeah. I just think like the normative work being done isn't necessarily one of a Christian perspective.
Good. Okay.
Because he goes like, oh, and I'm going to talk about these virtues, which is like, yes, play into my hands. But then he also goes, but I'm not going to talk about the Greek philosophy underlining it.
Right.
Like, he literally says that. And I'm like, right. you could take out his entire theory about Christianity.
Yeah.
And just substitute it with philosophy.
Good.
And then
you might have
like a purer understanding.
Excellent. And you're thinking
normative work.
Like, so you're thinking, well, look, what happens in the church in that period is that it's also trying to reconcile itself with Greek philosophy. So why don't we just go to the Greeks?
Yeah, he's talking about Aquinas and everything.
Right.
Or like Augustine or... And I'm like, but they're reading the philosophy, so why aren't you reading the philosophy?
Why don't I just go and talk about that?
Yeah.
So tell me about the pagan reading. So if the Christian parable approach, this is a kind of like, these are homilies to try and teach people about what not to do, and you think that's no good. How do you read this in a sort of pagan setting? What does that look like?
So someone says that they exemplify the Nordic heathendom, and that explicitly anti-Christian.
Yes.
So kind of just being, it's all about honor, and if you go and kill that person who hit you with a staff, you are just exemplifying what it is to have pagan strength and
good.
To be a hero. It's all about like who the heroes are of stories, or heroes having their downfall and you feel sorry for them because they were fated towards something and they had no choice but to act in a certain way.
Right, so we see all these people doing certain things, and you're thinking, or this reading says, we make sense of those actions or the stories about those actions being preserved because they help do the opposite kind of marketing job, right? It's the parables we're supposed to sort of say to people who are going to hopefully be Christians, is doing this evangelism that says something like, be a Christian because look how badly it goes for these losers who aren't being Christians. And this reading, the pagan one, says, look at how strong these people are, look how much the fates play a role in there, look how much this is blessed or cursed by the way that things should be. So on that reading, on that pagan reading that says, look at this, how it exemplifies a whole load of things that we value as pagans or whatever, doesn't that just bring out something really interesting, because they're precisely because they're non-Christian, brings out really interesting normative properties, like that this is more important than that, where this might be, you know, killing someone because they rode a horse. Like, isn't, I mean, that's an interesting reading, right? That's one way where we're getting something that's a different way of doing ethics, right? It's got different values. What's wrong with that reading?
It misses a massive historical jump.
Right.
So like, it was the kind of like romanticized pagan idea is so fixated on like what you would imagine the settlement period Iceland was fixated on.
Right.
Like, hocus pocus.
Yeah.
We're so, I was fated to do this. It's not my responsibility, but I have honor and pride, so I will reimburse you for my horrible action that I was fated towards.
Mm-hmm.
But the humanistic, like the Christian approach, that is so much more historically focused. Mm. It was like this, it's a kind of, when they took the, like a Christian understanding, they were like, it's so much more fixated on history. Mm. It's so much more historically accurate. It just, to me, doesn't do the moral explanation that it could do.
Okay.
Like, it's just not as interesting to read.
Yeah. Like, okay.
Oh yeah, like someone, but with the romanticized idea, it's kind of, it does miss a massive historical jump.
Mm.
You've got to think it was written by 13th and 14th century people.
Yeah.
Not okay. 10th.
Yeah.
So there is like a massive jump between like
who's,
you can, yeah, it's not going to be charged emotively in the same way that it was if it was written during the settlement period.
And so that's, so you're not on board with that reading of the sagas because you think that it's just not, it's not good scholarship, something like that, it's sort of anachronistic in some way, or it gets the history wrong, is that right? Or
yeah,
I guess the sequence of events.
And I think sometimes when you read it as well, it doesn't really, you might read it and you think this person is obviously doing the wrong thing. Yeah. Like Hrafnkell is the villain of this story. Mm-hmm. He is hated by every single person and everyone turns against him.
And he comes out on top.
But if you read it with this like pagan understanding, you'd have to think he's somehow the hero of a story.
All right, okay, right.
That he is like fated towards this horrible doom, but he loses everything, but he rises back up and he ends up in the same position, if not more powerful than he ever was before.
Right, and on this reading, so, on the pagan reading, we're supposed to be happy about that because he's
like,
our hero.
It's not his fault.
Right,
he's like,
right. But you think the text doesn't support that? You think the text actually encourages you to think that this is somehow like, that it encourages the audience to feel pretty mixed about this outcome at the end?
I don't think you could be a 14th century reader and feel that.
Right.
It's like an explanation based on maybe what someone in the 10th century would read it as.
Yeah.
Not that it doesn't do what you would, you wouldn't read it like that.
Okay.
It doesn't seem to be charged in that way to me. Yeah. Like, so, well, it's interesting. I think the theory does bring up a lot of interesting things, like this idea of like upright character, being a heroic character, having goodness based on strength or goodness based on fear.
Yeah.
Which does, I think, does motivate a lot of the work, but they're just virtues.
Okay.
Like, when you extract the good bits from it,
you don't need the
you can
the
take
pagan
away
story
the rest
it.
Of it.
Okay.
Like, so the Christian example is, they've based it on Aristotelian philosophy.
Okay, yeah.
And then with this one, they're talking about virtues, but they've just got the rest of it wrong.
Good, okay.
Just,
so you think
it's intuitively
what both of these get right is that they're interested in these
virtue,
character traits.
It's like
and these
the overlapping.
Right. Good, okay. So tell me about that. So when we think in this Aristotelian sense about virtues, there's things that I guess most people become familiar with about what Aristotle has to say about virtue, and when he talks about them as, so not the intellectual but the moral virtues being kind of character traits which are a mean between two vices, right? So if you go too far one way or too far the other way, then you're getting it wrong. But he also thinks that we can improve ourselves, that we have the possibility for moral improvement, so we can kind of practice the virtues and we can become better and better and more virtuous by constantly doing the things that are in this, a practical philosophy that says, and it's perfectionist, it says you should be aiming to get to this point of perfect balance between all these vices. And you don't think that the saga, at least not the story you just told me, that doesn't seem to be telling us to be good people, is it? I mean, is it trying to tell us, is it trying to give us examples? Is it a piece of moral education? Is helping you do moral decision making because it's showing you lots of people who are getting it wrong or something like that?
I don't think I don't think my approach is to say that the sagas are there to educate. Like, I don't think these are like a pamphlet selling virtue ethics to the Icelandic people.
Or doing a moral education just to educate them.
Like, I think, I'm just going to say, I'm just going to examine why, if you were to map a moral theory onto it.
Yeah, this fits fairly
it's
well.
It's virtue. Like, I don't think you necessarily have to extract Christianity. The same work could be being done without Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's excessively pagan, because if you remove pagan gods from it, all you're talking about is virtue.
Okay.
If you remove fate and this weird twisting of stories, you have the same virtues. You have, like, you're talking about people having good character. So I'm just kind of, like, mapping virtue onto that.
Okay.
Then I kind of need to go through it and say, like, why?
So do you think that the sagas put the sweet spot between the two vices? Do you think it puts them in a different place from the way that maybe Aristotle talks about it, or the way that we do? Do you think that they hold up as the virtuous thing to do, as being maybe in a slightly different place from, I mean, because that's a question we can ask Aristotle, right? So if courage is somehow the right position to be in comparison to being too cowardly, I suppose, is that one of the vices, and the other one is being too gung-ho and sort of over too keen to go into battle, right? And courage is somehow doing it in the right kind of proportion. And do you think that obviously the saga seems like it's talking about being courageous, but in other areas it seems to talk about things, but they seem excessive, they seem like they're getting them wrong. So are they trying to demonstrate to us people who are getting it wrong, or are they telling us, no, the sweet spot is not, here is precisely where people are getting it right? Is this guy getting it right when he kills a man for riding a horse? When he, I mean, is he acting virtuously because he said, look, I swore to you I would kill you, and so I'm just keeping my promises? This sounds like a person who's falling short of virtue. They're keeping their promises, even though their promises seem to be, the actions associated with those promises seem to be really extreme. Like, Do you get my question? I wonder if I've asked a sensible question. I guess my thought in a nutshell is, do you think that the Icelandic culture being described here finds virtue in different places from maybe where Aristotle or maybe we do? Or do you think they are demonstrating that these people have vices, and that we're seeing instances of them being vicious, and that's that when this guy cuts off someone's, you know, head or whatever for riding a horse, that's not acting virtuously, that's acting viciously. How do you read that, each of those cases?
I think there is examples of them acting with vice, which is the excess of their behavior is their downfall. So
when this guy says you've offered to settle with me, that means that we're now on equal terms. That guy is acting up and he's getting it wrong.
Yeah,
he's getting out of his place.
Because I think everyone, I don't want to, kind of goes against what I think, saying that you have a tiered system so people have different positions or values.
It's all about class war. It's class war.
But it kind of is. Like, in one of the readings that I did, he describes Iceland as having like four different tiers. You have like people who have no like freedom, like servants or whatever. And then you have like lowly farmers, which is like, or like destitute farmers, which is what Björn is. He is destitute. Then you have like wealthy farmers. And then you have like the Gothi. And the only difference that separates the two top tiers is like power.
Yeah.
So like Björn's like punching like two tiers above his weight.
Yeah.
But he,
which is why he has excess, which is why like, things go badly for him. So here's my question, though. So one of the things you might think there is, in that society you described, you've got four tiers of society, and that there are different sweet spots on that scale from vice to virtue in the middle, and that what the right thing to do is not just whether you're more towards this vice or more towards that vice or in the middle, but it's also precisely to do with what your role is, what your tier is in that society. It's not just the virtue question, it's also something to do with rank or role. So I don't know enough Aristotle, but you could imagine sort of in Greek society, you know, a virtuous slave, the virtues around what slaves should be, it's going to be quite different from a virtuous woman, and maybe quite different from what a virtuous man should be, because we just have different expectations about where the mean is for each of those people. Does that make sense? Do you think that's what's going on here? That there are different virtues for different classes of people.
Yeah, I think it does vary on the situation. You can't, if everyone acts directly in the middle between two vices, there is going to be a point where that's a deficiency. Like if you had a fireman and he was like, well, you know, I'm not going to not think about running the building, but I'm also not going to run in head on, not gauge my situation. But if not necessarily the middle is going to be the right amount for it to be a virtuous act.
Good. Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Like yeah, it's going to,
like maybe you'll be on taking Raff and Curl to the owl thingy to have it settled is a legitimate decision.
Yeah.
But it just gets taken too far. Like okay. They hang him upside down by his ankles and they take everything off him and they have him exiled and they take all his stuff and that just winds Raff and Curl up. He's just like, that's it.
Right.
I'm going to punish you for your excess. And he ends up killing the brother of Sam and he goes, because you took it too far. So I'm not going to settle that death with you because that's retribution for what you've done to me.
Right, so, okay, yeah.
Like Raff and Curl goes, you've pushed it too far this time.
Yeah.
So the, you can see where it could have stopped.
Right.
Where like Thorbjorn could have been a good citizen invested in like, in who was invested in the political sphere and legitimate resolution.
Yeah.
But he pushes it too far. But then I think that's one of the things I want to look at in my third section is whether it's Thorbjorn who pushes it too far.
Yeah.
Or whether it's Sam, his nephew, who does it to seek fame.
What might be appropriate for one of them might not be appropriate for another, right? That seems to be something you accept, right? So, and the reason that that might be, the reason that what might be appropriate for you to do that's not appropriate for me to do is partly to do with our roles, right? That, and that's something you accept as well, because you think, okay, so what's virtuous for a fireman is different from what's virtuous for a librarian. Yeah. So a librarian needs to be this courageous. But if you've got someone who's going to go into a fire, you need them to be kind of courageous in this way. So if you think that virtues are attached to sort of maybe roles or... Is role the right way of putting it? Like, because at first it was like a, almost like a class status, but now you're thinking maybe it's about the kind of role they play and about whether they're entitled to act in certain ways or expected or if it's appropriate for them to act in certain ways. That there are some characters that we associate with certain types of roles. Yeah. I mean, talking about fire, like people who are in the fire brigade is like a role, right? It's an institutional role. Is that the way you're thinking about it? Like, so that these... What's appropriate for one of these people and not for another is partly to do with their class, perhaps, but also partly to do with the what they contribute to that society or what their or is it just to do with their characters? Is it just to do with like their is it just to you the universal humanity, human nature, and so some people that everybody has the same obligations in some respects because they have to find the mean between the devices. Just you have to as much as I have to. It's no different.
I think it depends on the character. Mm. I think to know when to stop in a situation is something that they should all have.
Right.
Obviously, just knowing in what situation to stop depends on your position. Like, as a chieftain, you're probably going to push things a bit harder. In a position of punishment, you might say, I'm taking all his land off him.
Yeah.
Which would be just inappropriate for Thorbjorn to do because he doesn't have that like legal legitimacy.
Sort of going beyond his rank, it's more than his job's worth.
Then you're acting in a vice, as a vice, because you unlawfully taken something. You're not acting as a good citizen. You're not behaving as a good character. It's not going to reach a point of goodness. So what you're doing is vice.
What have you learned from this so far? I mean, not just about the philosophical stuff or about the Icelandic sagas. What have you learned about the process of writing sort of a long form piece and the process of doing a dissertation?
Sometimes I don't make any sense at all. Like I read back my sentences and I'm like, whoo, I can't even pretend I was drunk. Like this is just bad. I think sometimes I do it for my own enjoyment. So like I wrote like 4,000 words in about a week.
Wow.
And I took them to Fabian, who's managing my dissertation. He was like, you have written things here which are so irrelevant. It is beyond ridiculous.
Okay, good. Yeah.
I was just like, and Reykjavik comes from the word reyk, meaning smoke. And this because when they turned up at Iceland, they thought it was smoke, but it wasn't. It was steam coming from the geothermal energy below. And I was just like, it was just like 4,000 words of just me, just like,
But that's
speaking to the void,
and you're getting it out.
I'm gonna have to delete it all.
Yeah,
and I was like, oh,
is really? It satisfying? I mean, to kind of go through. I mean, obviously, deleting stuff is always a bit of a weird thing.
Well, but I would be lying if I said I deleted it. I just opened a new document.
Yeah, new document.
I kept that for my own.
That's excellent.
I'm gonna enjoy reading that.
One day you'll use it. Yeah.
Anyone want some facts?
Yeah.
It's basically just 4,000 words of like.
But do you feel like that's something you have to go through?
You have to write the
long bad version.
You have to like yell into the void before get it all out, because it's a passion project.
Right.
Like, what, you're not writing this because like write 2,000 words on like why Karl Popper. Do you know?
Okay, right. You're singling out my modules. Very good.
Because I saw the book
as pointless
Karl Popper over there. Not targeting you. But it's like, it's not, someone's not turned around and said, write about just war.
Yeah, okay.
Do 2,000 words.
They've given you.
Give it back to me.
They've given you the question, yeah.
I can do whatever I want with this. Two people are going to have to sit down and read it and mark it.
Yes,
and they will enjoy it. Yeah. I've enjoyed it. You will enjoy
it. That's great, yeah.
So, I don't know. It's like, I feel like you do have to scream in the void a bit, because otherwise you're going to have all these irrelevant. I don't know. You have to. I feel like part of it is feeling like you're telling someone about it.
Good.
Especially when you've picked a really weird topic.
Yeah.
I'm a bit like, I have read so many of these readings. And they like translate, so like some of the Icelandic letters, you obviously don't have in English, and they translate them to like a TH sound or like, and I was like, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get an Icelandic keyboard up, and every time I have to write one of these letters, I'm going to have to copy and paste it, and it's hassle.
Yeah.
But
it's
commitment. I'm only doing it purely for my own enjoyment.
That's great.
Because no one can read those words.
Yeah, that's good.
Doesn't make any sense.
No, really satisfying.
So I'm like, this is only...
It's funny, isn't it? The little things that come along at the same time as you're doing one project, that you actually pick up little things along the way, like obviously like knowing how to read these characters or whatever else. And but then like, little keyboard skills and stuff like that, where you're thinking like, I'm going to make this more efficient into my workflow. Right?
I was like, I'm going to do all this. And I was like, none of these readings do that.
Yeah.
It's purely for my own enjoyment.
That's really
like,
good.
I was like, so I don't know. It's like, it's of no value. I'm doing that to tickle myself.
It's eudaimonia. You're going flourishing.
Yeah,
you're going
I've reached the point of the mean, because I haven't put in 4,000 words of context.
No, really. Yeah.
But I have enjoyed.
You haven't got none.
A little bit I can put in.
You enjoy those little facts, right?
Yeah. So I was like, there was just like, I put one of the facts in, like just in brackets, because Fabian was like, you need to like put some stuff in the footnotes. Like,
footnotes.
Could have took that out and put that in a footnote.
So
now
footnotes.
I'm just like, a little bit of like, just put this.
Do you think differently about how you relate to the staff, like to Fabian, like his role in your project? Has that changed the way you think about, you know, what it's like to be a student, and now you're actually doing your own project, your own research project?
Now I'm like a grown-up adult.
Well, I didn't want to say
it
that
workload.
Way. Yeah, but something like that. Like, oh yeah, he's not. I'm not taking it to my supervisor to get him to give me a grade. You know, I'm actually looking for something else. I'm like feedback and encourage, you know, constructive criticism.
Admiration,
right. Maybe
you tell me it's brilliant and then let me go.
Yeah.
I'm not here for this.
I mean, I'm completely needy in that respect. Like I'm desperate for someone to tell me that my work is okay.
Tell me it's good or I'll die.
Yeah.
You didn't like my translations. I'm going.
But he's not going to evaluate that stuff. He'll probably say to you at the outset, like, I'm not an expert on Icelandic sagas, right? Because he's not. I mean, I know that. We shouldn't be ashamed about that. Because you've gone out alone, right? You've gone into areas that no one else here works on.
I feel like I'm like totally bluffing though. Like,
right.
Fabian will like try and say a word and he's like, oh, I don't know how to say that. And I'm like, you tell me anything.
But
you could meet an Icelander and you could be like, oh, I like did a dissertation with one of my students and this is how you say this word, and you go, that's not true.
But do you feel like that you do have some standing in these things? Obviously that like Fabian doesn't. Like there are definitely respects here where you're more informed than he is. You've read more of this stuff than your supervisor has, right?
Yeah, which is like totally scary for me, because like I was speaking to one of the lecturers, he's like head of Scandinavian studies at Edinburgh,
right?
And I was like, he was like super interested, and I would be scared to send him this,
right?
Because like, I may be the expert of Queen's philosophy on Icelandic saga morality, but I'm sure if I went to the head of Scandinavian studies, I'd probably be pushed down a peg or two.
But how was that engagement? How did that go with this person in Edinburgh?
I owe him my life. I was like, just emailed him, like, because I'd spoken to him a while ago, because like when I started this passion project and I wrote my 4,000 words of Icelandic context, I was like, I'm going to do Scandinavian studies and it's going to be the best thing ever. And then I slowly realized that actually it's enough to make me want to pull my teeth sometimes.
Oh, right.
Huh. As much as I enjoy it, like, you know, yeah. you do hit a wall at points, yeah, totally. Especially when there's like, you can't access a reading on it.
Yeah.
Like when there's one book you need and it stops you being able to write because you cannot access this material anywhere.
Yeah.
It's enough to make you want to start your head off a wall.
Yeah.
So.
And then this person's just like, yeah.
And he was just genuinely like, oh, just write the best you can do. Like, I'll send you this book. He sent it first class delivery to my door. Was like, just donate it to your library when you're done with it. Like, just do the best you can do. And I was like, you know, some academics.
Yeah.
Really.
Some of us are good. I mean, some of them are good.
Some of them.
Okay, that was Aoife, a philosophy student at Queen's University Belfast, talking about Icelandic sagas and so much more. Thanks, Aoife, for agreeing to be involved. Hope you all feel encouraged that you can get in touch to let me know what you made of this episode, or if you'd like to start a follow-up conversation about anything that's been discussed on any of the other episodes. You can drop me a line through the contact page of the podcast website. That's www.generousquestions.co.uk. Or you can get in touch with me on Twitter, at Dr. Joe Morrison. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on your podcast platform if you get a chance and you feel like it. This has been Generous Questions. Thanks for listening.